Some of you were in Eye Opener, and if I were quick enough, it would be nice to build the whole thing today, Three Ways of Following Jesus, on Rich's Three Ways of Looking at the Road. It narrows down, it stays the same, it gets wider. Which one is right? Yes. And it all depends on what you see, and what you see depends on what you know, and he can take anything and make a lemonade, but in order to make a lemonade, you have to choose, and you not only have to choose, but you have to cut up the lemon, and you have to squeeze the lemon. And so there are three ways of following Jesus, but you could also ask which one is right, and the answer is yes. What you see depends on what you know, and you have to make choices, and in order to make choices, you have to cut up the lemon, and you have to squeeze the lemon, and that's all really what we're going to be doing this hour. We're going to be cutting some things up. We're going to be analyzing them. We're going to be dissecting them. We're going to be squeezing some words. We're going to be laying out some options and suggesting some kinds of choices. So, in order to start that cutting up the lemon business, we have to maybe talk something about some terms, and let's for a couple of minutes simply talk about the word ethics. If you've looked at the board, the word ethics goes across this 9:15 session today, tomorrow, and Friday. And then there are subtopics today, three ways of following Jesus, tomorrow, thinking about doing God's will, and the third one isn't up yet because I don't know yet what that's going to be, but I probably will by tomorrow. The word ethics has a number of cognates. In the first place, sometimes it is used in the singular, ethic. People want to talk about the Christian ethic, or people talk about Christian ethics. Those words are synonymous. I don't think that there is any difference whatsoever in talking about the Christian ethic or in talking about Christian ethics. Okay? The word ethical is quite different. The word ethical has a positive content to it. If someone is ethical, that doesn't just mean that they do ethics or think about ethics. An ethical person is a good person, okay? So the word ethical is very different from the word ethics or ethics or ethics singular. There's also a word ethos. That's a transliteration of a Greek term. Some of you may know of the book by Werner Ehlert entitled The Christian Ethos, E-T-H-O-S. The same root, slightly different word, and it carries slightly different connotations. Ethos carries connotations of description rather than normative. That is, ethos means the stall, actually, in which an animal lives. And the Christian ethos is a way of putting the whole question and the problem, which emphasizes a description of the place where Christians do in fact live. That's a little bit different from laying out norms and principles and rules and laws. So you have ethics, ethical, ethos. Sometimes the word is divided up into parts. So people sometimes talk about theoretical ethics and practical ethics, where theoretical ethics would be to think about how to make decisions, and practical ethics would be talking about those decisions. For instance, homosexuality, abortion, or whatever. Sometimes people talk about general ethics and special ethics, where general ethics is how to think about making decisions, and special ethics is special problem areas, okay? Some people decide to talk about personal ethics and social ethics. I think that's a little bit of a Mickey Mouse distinction, because if personal ethics isn't social, it isn't Christian ethics, and if social ethics doesn't have something to do with the person, it isn't Christian ethics. But some people sometimes make that distinction between personal ethics, how does an individual make decisions and how does an individual behave, and social ethics having to do with larger political and social questions. Some people distinguish between microethics and macroethics, where microethics has to do with little things, and macroethics has to do with world hunger and social justice throughout the world, and how to get the economics and the politics meshed with one another, and so on. So there are a lot of different kinds of categories which people use. Some people talk sometimes about meta-ethics. Meta-ethics has to do with the language, analyzing the language with which people do ethics. A word that is very often connected with ethics is the word moral, and that has a number of cognates too. The word moral is kind of like the word ethical. If you say, she's a moral woman, that means pretty much the same as saying she's an ethical woman. She's a good woman. She does the right thing. But morals, that's different from moral. Morals can be either good or bad. Say, she has fine morals, good morals. Or say, terrible morals. Moral means good, but morals can be good or bad. Morality, that's a neutral term too. Morality can be good morality or bad morality. Mores, M-O-R-E-S, is very much like the word ethos. That is to say, it emphasizes the description of how people do in fact behave without bringing any judgment to bear on that. Mores is a word that anthropologists use. You go to the South Sea Islands and you describe the mores of people, and supposedly you pass no judgment on that. You simply describe how they behave. So there are a lot of those terms, and I think it's worthwhile squeezing them a little bit, cutting them up, analyzing them a little bit, because what you see is what you know, and what you know helps you to see, and so it's worth talking about that a little bit, and we're going to be talking about that these days. The subtitle today is Three Ways to Follow Jesus. One thing that someone might say is, three ways, there's only one way. Jesus says, I am the way. That's it. There is only one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one Lord and God and Father of us all. There's only one gate, and it's very narrow. There's one way to follow Jesus. That's to take up your cross and follow him. I try to take care of that by saying that we're following Jesus. Christian ethics has to do with following Jesus and only following Jesus. There is only one way. Jesus is the way. That's true. But when you start to follow him, then there are a number of ways to do that. I suppose it would be possible to talk about three ways how not to follow Jesus. You remember in Luke 9, 57, where Jesus says, take up your cross and follow me, there are three people here. One comes up and says, I'll follow you anywhere you go. And Jesus says, foxes have holes, birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. And the implication is the guy says, oh, and takes off in the other direction. Another one says, Lord, I'll follow you, but first I have to go bury my father. Remember, Jesus says, let the dead bury their own dead. And The third one says, yes, I'll follow you, but first I want to say bye-bye. People at home, Jesus says, nothing doing. You follow me now. So I suppose it would be possible to talk about three ways not to follow Jesus. We're not going to talk about three ways not to follow Jesus. We're going to talk about three ways to follow Jesus. I use the word Jesus rather than Christ because I think we've got a little bit of a crisis going in the church at the present time. A little bit of a failure of nerve, and I'm concerned about that, and it takes many shapes and forms, but basically I think it amounts to a fuzzing out of the prime focus of the Christian faith. You can do that in many ways, but you can do that even with the word Christ, where Christ gets detached from Jesus and becomes an idea of some kind or an experience of some kind. John Cobb has a book entitled Christ in a Pluralistic Age, and he says Christ means that which is supremely important. What you call that which is supremely important equals Christ. That's not very important. So you can, some people call him Buddha, we call him Jesus, but what you call him doesn't matter. What's important is the Christ, and Christ equals that which is supremely important. I want to say Jesus because it seems to me that the Christian faith is not an ideology, that's not an idea, that's not whatever happens to grab you. The name Jesus is what is non-negotiable for Christians. And you can call him Christ, you can call him Lord, you can call him a door, you can call him a vine, you can call him a shepherd, you can call him the mediator of a new covenant, you can call him the lamb slain from the foundation of the world. The New Testament calls him all kinds of titles. There's only one Jesus, and Christians are people who go back and back and back and back to the records which describe his birth and life and death and resurrection and reign and return. So Jesus is important in that title, and I guess follow is also important, and I would distinguish following from imitating. If all we had to do is imitate Jesus, then we should read through those documents and all get ourselves some sandals and a robe and maybe grow beards and certainly not get married and all move to Israel, etc. Huh? The problem is not to imitate Jesus. The problem is to follow Jesus. And I want to say that one way to squeeze the lemon, to cut the lemon and squeeze it and make lemonade, is to talk about three ways. I should say, too, that there is nothing particularly important about the number three. There is something terribly important about the number three if we're talking about God. God is triune. And you better not fuss around with fours and fives. You're talking about God. But we're talking about ways to follow Jesus. It's possible to talk about five ways to follow Jesus, or six, or seven, or eight, or two, or whatever. I'm talking about three simply because it seems to me that as one looks upon the church's reflection on how to act, how to behave, how to make decisions, it is possible to organize it in terms of three different approaches. It's possible to cut the lemon in three different ways. Let me say one other preliminary thing. I realize I may have already have lost some of you by all of this prolegomena, introductory junk, but I think it's of some importance to say a few things like this. There are people who don't think that ethics is worth doing. Maybe some of you don't think ethics is worth doing, because ethics is thinking about behaving. It isn't behaving. Ethics is to behavior what theology is to faith. There are a lot of people who don't think theology is worth doing because what's important is believing. Yes, what's important is believing. The only point of theology is to assist us in believing. If theology doesn't do that, let's not do theology. The point is to believe in Jesus. And sometimes theology might get in the way. If it gets in the way, forget it. Theology is supposed to help us to believe. I think it does help. Ethics ought to help us to behave, but it's not behaving. It's to help us behave. But there are people who think that ethics isn't worth doing. One type of person who thinks ethics isn't worth doing is the person who thinks, we already know what to do. You have to think about what to do. We know what to do. Romans 7, Paul says, the good that I would, I do not. The good that I would not, that I do. The problem is not knowing what to do. The problem is doing it. So why sit around and think about what to do? We know what to do. It's in the Bible. It's in our conscience. It's written in the sky. It's in the ground. It's in the laws of the land. Whatever. We know what to do. So why think about it? Well, there's a second type of person who thinks ethics isn't worth doing, and that person thinks ethics isn't worth doing because it really doesn't matter what we do. That takes a lot of shapes and varieties, too. It cannot matter because we're all going to hell in a basket anyway. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Why be moral? Why be good? The atmosphere is going to be polluted so entirely by next year that it's not going to make any difference or whatever. Or it doesn't matter what we do because we can all get forgiven tonight or this afternoon, and so life is simply a matter of sinning and getting forgiven, and that doesn't ever change, and so it really doesn't matter what you do. So there are two kinds of people who think ethics isn't worth doing. On the one hand, people who think we already know what to do, and secondly, people who think it doesn't matter. The church has done ethics through its entire life because, number one, the church has thought it does matter what we do. Matters a whale of a lot what we do. The fact that we can be forgiven doesn't mean it doesn't matter what we do. It matters a lot what we do. And secondly, what to do isn't all that obvious. In almost all of the decisions that we make in life, it isn't all that obvious how to decide what's right from what's wrong. So the church has thought about the Christian life. And Christian ethics is thinking about, it's reflecting on Christian behavior. Okay. Three ways to follow Jesus. I'm going to try to sketch these out a little bit, and there will be time to talk. If you want to raise questions of clarification on the way, please feel free to do that. I'll tell you, first of all, that the three that I'm going to try to sketch out are, number one, what I would call the absolutist way, and number two, the situationist way, and number three, the consequentialist way. I will go back through those one by one. They're all in the Bible. They're all in the history of the church. They are all, I think, probably in each of us as we try to think about how to follow Jesus. Let's talk first about the absolutist. An absolute is something that is not relative. The word absolute is a polar term to the word relative. Something that's absolute does not depend on circumstances. It's absolute, that means it's every time and every place, every person. If you take, for instance, Matthew, let's say 5:16, Matthew 5:16, the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, let your light so shine before people that they'll see your good works and glorify your Father who's in heaven. I think the assumption behind that is that everybody knows a good deed when one sees a good deed. It's obvious. So if you do what's right, you don't have to tell people, hey, look, I'm a good guy. They'll know that. Because good is, the right thing, right behavior, is universal. Doesn't require any thinking at all. You let your light shine, people see it, they glorify God. Another passage in the Sermon on the Mount, in Matthew 7, Jesus says, you don't hang good fruit on a bad tree. You remember that. What has to happen is that the tree will become good, and then the fruit will automatically come. So that what is necessary is to have a good will, to be a good person, and then all of those good things that we all know are good will automatically be done. Or let's take the Ten Commandments. At least the way most people read the Ten Commandments, they constitute absolute, that is, not relative requirements. Thou shalt not kill. That doesn't mean it's okay to kill on Friday, but not on Thursday. Doesn't mean it's okay to kill in Cincinnati, but not in New York. Thou shalt not kill, period. That's an absolute. Every time, every place, every person, every era, every party, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit adultery. People who tend to think in absolutist terms tend to like the Ten Commandments. There's a word for the absolutist way of doing things, and the word is that ethicists use is deontology, deontology, and it comes from a Greek word de, which means it is necessary. It's necessary to do the right thing. It's always necessary to do the right thing. Absolutist ethics is an ethic of obligation. I am obligated. It is necessary to do the right thing. Another word that is connected with an absolutist way of thinking about following Jesus, or a way to follow Jesus, an absolutist way to follow Jesus, is the word universalizability. Okay? It comes from a fellow by the name of Immanuel Kant, and what we're describing here is really a basic Protestant way of following Jesus. Most Protestants tend to be on this absolutist line. And the person who laid it down in its purest way is a fellow by the name of Immanuel Kant, German philosopher, who said, so act, so that you can will your action as a universal law for all humankind. That is to say, if you decide to do something, you ought to do it in such a way that you would want everybody to do that. Now, most of us have said to our children, and most of us have heard from our parents, when we've wanted to do something or other, what if everybody did that? Right? That's a principle of universalizability. It's a way of testing one's behavior. So Kant talks, for instance, about promise-keeping. He says, keeping your promise, is an absolute obligation. It's always right to keep your promise. It's always wrong not to keep your promise. Or telling the truth. Truth-telling is an absolute obligation. There is never a time when it's right to tell a lie. And the reason for that is that although you may be able to rationalize in your own mind that it's okay in this one little instance to tell a little lie, Kant says what you cannot do is to will lying as a universal law for all humankind. Because then lying wouldn't even work. Because lying only works because people expect that you're going to tell the truth. Right? But if you will lying as universal law for all humankind, the whole system breaks down. Same way with promise keeping. Kant says it's very easy to rationalize, and you want to borrow this money, and you really need that. You really need it. And you know that you can't pay it back, but in order to get the loan, you have to promise to get it back. So you get the loan, and it's good that you get the loan. You can do some good things with the loan, and it makes a lot of sense to promise to pay it back even though you know you can't. Kant says, yes, I can understand that, how you can rationalize that in a specific case, but what you cannot do is will promise breaking as a universal law for all humankind. Because if everybody breaks promises, then promises don't work anymore, right? So Kant says that what is really important is the will. And absolutists would say this too. What's really important is the will. What results from your action is not important. The consequences of your action are not important. What is important is a good will. And Kant says there is nothing in this world that can be called good without qualification except the good will. So what's important is the good tree out of which the good fruit naturally comes. And Luther, of course, says the same thing. Luther says good works don't make a man good, but a good man does good works. So it's a very Protestant kind of way of following Jesus. What's necessary is to get converted, and once you get converted, those good works will naturally follow. You can hear that from Billy Graham also. There's a wide range of absolutists, and there are some very, very sophisticated people. Paul Ramsey is one of them. Some of you know him. He's one of the most sophisticated people doing ethics in this country, and he's largely on that line. Let's go to the second way, situationist way of doing ethics. The absolutist says, right is always right, wrong is always wrong. We can't start saying, well, because of my circumstances, it's all right to tell a little white lie. No. If it's not right for everybody, it's not right for you. So act so that you can will your action as a universal law for all humankind. The situationist says the opposite. Situationist says, well, it all depends on the situation. In fact, it all depends on the situation. These people are not at all, they're not at all people who don't want to follow Jesus, necessarily. There's some absolutists who don't want to follow Jesus either. But there are people who see that road getting narrower rather than wider or whatever. They cut the lemon in a different way. They squeeze it in a different way. They make a different kind of lemonade. Because they know things and they see things differently from the absolutists. So, for instance, Jesus, they would say, is a situationist in that, remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. The absolutist says that means everybody, every place, every time. Jesus says, you hungry? Pick the corn and eat it. It's all right. Your ox falls in the hole, haul it out. And they were scandalized. They were absolutely scandalized because Jesus broke the laws right and left, depending on the situation. And situationists are apt to see those kinds of stories in the New Testament more perhaps than some others. Or they would read, for instance, Matthew 25, where you remember the people who have been feeding the sick and visiting those in prison. Jesus says, go to my right hand, and they don't even know they've been doing it, right? When did we feed the hungry? When did we visit you in prison? And the people who think they've been doing it, who are very sure they've been doing it, they haven't been doing it, right? So there's that huge surprise element. And so what matters is responding responding in the situation, and if an absolutist ethic is an ethic of obligation, deontology, it is necessary, then the situationist ethic is an ethic of response, not obligation to eternal, unchangeable laws, but it's response to situation. So, for instance, the Good Samaritan story of Jesus. The one guy comes along, and he has promised to be at a meeting at 10 o'clock. Here's this guy lying in the road, but I've promised to be at the meeting at 10 o'clock. They're depending on me. Onward and upward, I'll go to the meeting for the opening bell. Okay, he's keeping his promise. Jesus says, sorry, here's a new situation, and you better respond to it like that. Huh? 1 Corinthians 9, you remember Paul. Paul says, to the Greeks I became a Greek, to the Romans I became a Roman, to the uncircumcised I became uncircumcised, to the circumcised I became circumcised, I become all things to all men. Respond to the situation. And if you read through 1 Corinthians, it's absolutely remarkable. People want to know, should we eat meat or shouldn't we eat meat? Paul says, well, it all depends. You read that chapter 8 through 11. They want to know, should we get married or shouldn't we get married? He says, well, it all depends. You can get married or you don't get married. You might eat meat or maybe you shouldn't. They want to know, should we speak in tongues? Paul says, well, I do it myself. If it turns you on, it's all right. But, really, I'd rather speak five with my mind than 10,000 in a tongue. But it's all right. It's all right. It all depends on the situation. There's all kinds of situationist ethics in the scriptures. And so there are people who have taken that particular way of following Jesus, and they've thought about it, they've squeezed the lemon, and they've built whole ethical systems out of it. Sometimes situationism is called contextualism because people say it all depends on the context. It's a very similar kind of word. If the will is important in absolutism, there's nothing good in this world without qualification except the goodwill, then I suppose maybe the feelings are more important in situationism. You kind of, you respond, you don't always have a reason for it, it doesn't come out of an automatic absolute will, but you've got a heart, you're compassionate, there's a need, and you meet it. If one worries about what's right in an absolutist context, then for a situationist, one worries about what is appropriate. It's a different kind of question. The absolutist asks, what's right? And what's right is always right. Situationist asks, what's appropriate? What is fitting? What fits the situation? And so you find these people these situationist types, not writing rules and regulations and laws, but what they do is tell stories. Sometimes it gets very maddening if you want rules and they give you a story. You say, what's right? What should I do? They say, well, there was this woman, see? You say, yeah, I know. But I want to know what's right. What's the right thing to do? They say, well, there was this guy, see? So they tell stories like D.T. Niles, a Salonese Christian, was with the World Council of Churches, and he was a kind of a situationist in ethics, and he was making this point, and he's told about a fellow who visited a friend of his in another city, and the friend said, come home for dinner, and so he brought him home, and the fellow rang the doorbell, his wife came to the door, and he gave her a big hug and kissed her, and they sat in the living room for a while, and the wife said, the dinner's ready, and they ate, and he got up after dinner, and he said, thanks, honey, gee, that was fantastic, and gave her a big hug and smothered her with kisses, and they talked a while, and he had to go to the airport, and before the fellow left, he hugged his wife and smothered her with kisses, and they walked down the sidewalk, and this guy who was visiting said, do you always do that? And he said, well, is this the secret of our happy marriage these 25 years? And so on the airplane, this guy's thinking, gee, maybe that's a good idea. So he goes home and rings the doorbell. His wife comes to the door and opens it, and he grabs her and hugs her and smothers her with kisses, and she sits down on the sofa and starts crying her head off. And he says, what's wrong, dear? And she says, first Johnny gets the measles, then the washing machine breaks, now you come home drunk. Niles is saying that things aren't simply and immediately transportable. Huh? Joseph Sittler, some of you know his name, has a book entitled The Structure of Christian Ethics. He talks about a convoy in World War II where the German U-boats have sunk one of the ships in the convoy, and that there are men from that ship floating around in life jackets in the oil slick, and the sonar device and the destroyer zeroes in on that submarine, and the captain then has the decision whether to throw those depth charges, get the submarine, and keep that submarine from torpedoing yet more ships in the convoy. But if he does that, he's also going to kill his own men on the surface. Or to save his own men and let that submarine go, maybe to torpedo who knows how many more ships. And the captain stands on the bow of the ship and says one must do what one must do and say one's prayers. And the point is that there is no right thing to do there. One must decide. It's a messy world. It's an ambiguous world. And so one has to make those kinds of decisions. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, when he was in prison being interrogated, I'm telling you stories because we're talking about situationist ethics, and situationists tell stories, right? Bonhoeffer was a kind of a situationist. He was in prison. They were interrogating him. They wanted to know the names of people in on the plot to kill Hitler, etc. Bonhoeffer knew those names, and he was lying his head off. He knew Kant very well. He knew absolutist ethics very well, and that bothered him. He's wondering what to do. He wrote a little essay entitled "What Is Meant by Telling the Truth." And he tells a story about a sixth grade girl who is in class. The teacher said, Sally, your father comes home drunk every night, doesn't he? And the girl says, no, he does not. And then Bonhoeffer analyzes that. And he said, what is meant by telling the truth? After all, Jesus said, I am the truth. A person is the truth. Not a sentence, but a person is the truth. What does that mean? Pilate couldn't understand that. Bonhoeffer says, maybe the teacher told a lie by asking the question. by putting that little girl into that kind of a situation. Maybe the girl told the truth by protecting the sanctity of her home. Maybe truth is personal rather than grammatical or something. The situationist worries about what is fitting, what is appropriate. There is a tendency to do it in terms of feeling rather than in terms of the will. There is abundant biblical background for it. Let's talk a moment about consequentialist ethics. We're talking about three ways to follow Jesus. Consequentialist might say, does say, what really matters is not the act that may or may not be appropriate, not the will out of which the act comes. What matters is the results, the consequences. That's what matters. I don't give a rip what your motives are or your intentions. Or what, how you feel about it. It couldn't matter less. What matters is the result, the consequences. It's called consequentialism, okay? And if absolutism tends to be an ethic of obedience, and situationism tends to be an ethic of response, then consequentialism tends to be an ethic of goals, okay? You don't look inside of yourself at all. You look at the whole world, you look at your neighbors, you look at the society, and you say, here's where we want to get. How are we going to get there? So that, for instance, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 10, when he's talking about meat eating, he says, all things are lawful. You can do anything you want. But not all things are helpful. Not all things are expedient. Everything's okay. If you're a Christian, there's nothing that is outlawed. But that doesn't mean everything is going to achieve the results that we want to achieve. That's a consequentialist way of talking. Or Jesus says, seek first the kingdom of God. And then don't worry about all this other stuff. It'll come. See? You get your goals straight. Then it'll happen. And there is, in the New Testament, there is a massive drive toward the goal of the resurrection and the return of Christ and the new heaven and the new earth. Everything is moving in that direction. So the consequentialist tends to say, what's really important is to get to that goal. And we ought to act in such a way that we'll get there. Seek first the kingdom. Let's do what's helpful. Let's do what builds up the body toward the coming of the kingdom. These folks, I suppose, tend to be have a greater emphasis upon reason. If the absolutists tend to emphasize the will, Kant says, there's no moral worth in eating oatmeal if you like it. The only, because then you're just, you know, you're just following your genes or something. But there is moral worth. If you hate oatmeal, if you hate it with a passion, and you eat it every morning out of sheer will, that is a moral act. That's a very Victorian kind of thing, where there's a will, there's a way. The emphasis upon the will. The situationist tends to say, how's it feel to you? Does it feel appropriate? The consequentialist uses his noggin or her noggin. It's a very rational kind of thing. You figure out what your goal is, and then you figure out how you're going to get there. And so, as you would expect, I think, whereas absolutist ethics is a very Protestant way of doing things, consequentialism is a very Roman Catholic way of doing things. And there is an emphasis upon the end, the result. And you all know that the Jesuits at one time, or some Jesuit at one time, said, the end justifies the means. Now, most Protestants think that's just awful. That's just terrible.
But it's not terrible if what's important is the end, the result. That's what's really important. And so the means are always of secondary importance. The only purpose of the means is to reach the end. So that was laid out in great detail by Aristotle many years ago, and it was picked up by Thomas Aquinas, and it was worked into a whole total system. And these people don't ask what's right as the absolutists. They don't ask what is appropriate as the situationists ask. They ask, what is good? What is the good result? What's good for you? What's good for me? What's good for society? There were people in England a couple centuries ago who picked up this stream of thinking, and sometimes it's called teleology, because telos means end in Greek, and it emphasizes the end. And these people, Jeremy Bentham, John Stuart Mill, James Mill, others, called their position utilitarianism. And utilitarianism means that you worry about the utility of a thing, that is, the usefulness of a thing, in bringing about the end that you want to reach. And they worked that out in very great detail, and they talked about the hedonistic calculus, because the main principle is to bring well-being or pleasure to the greatest good for the greatest number, and you calculate that. You calculate it according to various criteria. And that requires some thinking. Now, there are all kinds of very practical outcroppings of each of these three. While we're on consequentialism, let me mention a couple of those, and then we'll have whatever questions or comments you want to raise. For instance, if we're talking about the ecology, we're talking about ecology. If we're talking about human rights, social justice, consequentialist would say, what do we want the world to look like in the year 2000? What do we want the air to smell like? What do we want Lake Erie to smell like in the year 2000? Okay, would side that. Well, now we have to decide if we want to be there in the year 2000, what do we have to do to get there? What are the means to reach that end? And they would say, you can't get very far simply asking what's right. You can't get very far asking what is appropriate in this particular moment. You have to ask, what is the means that is going to achieve that end? One other example, the Lutheran Church in America and the American Lutheran Church, many other denominations have radically changed their budgeting systems. Some of you know that and some of you don't. But we used to operate on a pie budget, and you simply divide up the pie, 15% to theological education, 25% to world mission, 10% to home mission or whatever. You get your slice of the pie and you go and do with it what you want. There's a whole new system called PPBS. Some people say, you know what PP is, you know what BBS is, all right, that's a good system. It means, I think, something like program planning budgeting systems, and it was dreamed up by McNamara and the Whiz Kids back in whosever administration they worked for. When what did they work for? Eisenhower? Who were those? Johnson? Oh, Kennedy. All right. Whatever. They dreamed that up, and you can go to the University of Michigan and you learn all about PPBS. Well. What PPBS is essentially a consequentialist way of following Jesus. Because you have to set goals, you have to set objectives, you have to say, not just I get 15% of the pie, but you have to write project proposals. You have to say, all right, this is what I want to accomplish, and this is how I'm going to test whether in 3 years it has been accomplished. So there's accountability built into that system, which was never built into the PI system, and it all has to do with ends and means and goals and how you reach them. Okay, Jesus says, take up your cross and follow me. I hope there's no question among Christians about whether to follow Jesus. But I also hope there are questions among Christians about how to follow Jesus. There ought to be no question about whether to follow Jesus. There ought to be lots of questions about how to follow Jesus. And there are ways to talk about that. There are ways, to squeeze the lemon. It makes a difference what you know for what you see in a problem. And these are simply three ways of organizing patterns of following Jesus. They're all in the Bible. They're all throughout the history of the church. Probably all of us use different aspects of these from time to time. But I would venture to say that each of us in this room is primarily one of the three. Each of us is primarily an absolutist or a situationist or a consequentialist. So that's something to maybe think about a little bit. I'm wondering if you have any comments or questions.
In the 11th chapter of Hebrews, there are persons mentioned of outstanding faith, and one of them is Rahab. Now, if you read back in the Old Testament where she told a lie. And the result of her telling the lie was that those spies were not apprehended or discovered. And afterwards, when the city was surrounded and so on, they promised her that if she and her household or her family were in one place, she would be saved. And she is mentioned as a heroine of faith in the little chapter of faith.
Right.
There you have this situation.
That's right. She's not mentioned in Immanuel Kant's Fundamental Principle of the Metaphysic of Morals, because if you're an absolutist, you tend to forget people like that, right? But there she is in the Bible. Okay. Yes?
It seems to me, as you said, that there is indeed every individual has one particular line to follow. I belong into the first category. However, I find it more and more difficult to follow this category because the world gets more and more complex.
Yes.
And the complexity of the world does not allow for this is right and this is wrong anymore. So I guess everybody has to use one approach. The second approach is primarily the pragmatic approach. What works is the thing. And so I suppose that at times we all say, well, I would rather say this is right, but then I would not get that way. It must be pragmatical. I cannot be stubborn and say only this way. And the situationist, no, the consequentialist. Consequentialist?
Consequentialist.
Consequentialist.
Right.
Is right too, because he sets goals to achieve. However, the danger is here that you might achieve something that you haven't wanted that you set out.
Yes.
Goal, you may think that what you are setting out for may achieve that goal, only to find out 3 years later that it didn't achieve the goal at all.
Right.
And that you were really squandering around, and that did not get you where it is. It also may be that I say, for instance, it can be used very much in the unethical sense. For instance, Hitler said, well, I do not like Jews, period. Therefore, we get rid of it. In so and so way, I will achieve it. And he did.
Right.
But you have to have the morals, and the morals is the thing that's important, because the goal that you reach, if that goal is not set by a absolute, then what you are setting here is a thing that you can get in a heck of a lot of trouble.
You can get in a lot of trouble. You can get in a lot of trouble in any one of these, right? And so there are huge pluses and huge minuses
in each one of these, and that's why it's good to cut the lemon and to squeeze it and to reflect on what one does. Another problem with consequentialism is, of course, that in the calculating of how to get to the goal, you have to use data, and the data is never all in. You never get all the data. And so, you know, we want to get rid of mosquitoes, so we spray DDT, and then we find out later what we've done with DDT, and that happens, of course, all the time. So that calculating consequences is very, very tricky, and that's why some people move back into that absolutist thing. And each one of these can be done in an offhand, sloppy way, or can be done in a very sophisticated way. And that's why I mentioned Paul Ramsey in that absolutist category, because no one can accuse Paul Ramsey of being simplistic. And yet he tends to be an absolutist. He says we've got to use that kind of thinking if we want to follow Jesus. Huh? And so he says we must not say the end justifies the means. And Paul Ramsey says we must have an ethic of means, because it's the means that are important, huh? Not the end. And I think that came out, for instance, in Alex Funke's talk about Betel, too. If you're a consequentialist, then you figure these people, you know, our job is to get everything revved up for the war effort. These people are useless. Therefore, we do away with them. Huh? But if you have some absolute commitment to the value of human life, then regardless of the consequences, you're not going to do that. But there are pluses and minuses all the way across the board. It's important, I think, to realize that. The bell has rung. The coffee is there. Tomorrow, we're going to do ethics again. The title on the board is Thinking About Doing God's Will, and we're going to cut the pie in a different way. We're going to go at it in a different way, but it's the same general topic. Okay?